ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan for your Friday. Happy New Year, cricket podcast fans. Oh, it's great to be here as we're a couple of days out from the start of the Sydney Test match. First of all, my podcast co-host, former Australian opener, Ed Cowan. Hello, Teddy.
Corby, happy New Year.
Here we are.
New year, new me.
Same old show.
Same old show. How was your New Year's Eve?
It was good. It was sort of, as we like to say, low key. Just went around to a mate's house and then watched fireworks and that was it. Back home, in bed, ready to start. No, ready to start 2026 on the right note. How was yours?
Wasn't low key. Pushed the boat out way too far.
Yeah, right.
For this aging body to deal with it. But I'm back. I'm fresh today.
I was about to say, is this a 2-day hangover thing, or are you feeling much better?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
I like it. I like it. As you should capitalize on the great spot in which you reside, Teddy, in the beautiful city of Sydney. The most important thing, is it raining up there? They haven't put the stumps in the ground yet, but any danger of getting some cricket underway?
Well, I haven't seen the sun for about 4 days. It's been feeling very Melbourne-like. And guess what the forecast is on Sunday?
Thunderstorms.
Storms.
Yeah. There we go.
Right on cue, folks. That's death taxes and rain at the Sydney Test.
Man, Sydney has like the best climate, or at least it did, had the best climate in the country, and yet for whatever reason, whenever the Test match rolls around, and it's uncanny, isn't it? That week in particular, every year, it feels like it rains.
It is. It's a bad place to live for about 10 days a year, and just so happens to coincide with 5 days of Test cricket.
So the forecast, 27 storms, 26, a bit of rain day two, and then it finds up 26, 28, 30 with the big sun emoji, which we love on the on the forecast watch for days 3 to 5 of the Test match. As we record this, Teddy, which is early on a Friday morning, I appreciate you making the time early out because there is some breaking news. And you'd be thinking, geez, this breaking news got to do with Usman Khawaja. Well, yes, but we'll get to that. But this isn't the story that I bring to the table today. The story that I bring to the table is that I've been hearing through my sources that there is a Knott's reunion that is taking place later today. And maybe that is the reason for the early record time. And that some former Test cricketers, including the likes of Graham Swan and Stuart Broad, could be sort of huddled together in this Knott's reunion, which includes Michael Lahm, of course, who's your notable player agent and former England cricketer, and Ed Cowan.
Where did you get this from?
Is this true?
It is true. Oh. But, well, I mean, you're a journalist at heart. I have not mentioned that to you, so I have no idea where. Your sources are very good. But, yes, there will be some golf later this afternoon.
Yeah,
come
good.
On, people don't want to hear about that.
No,
Crack on.
No, but a lot of people probably wouldn't be aware that, I mean, you played county cricket. You obviously played against these guys for a long period of time, but you also called them teammates for an extended period as well.
Yeah, for half a season at Knott's. I mean, my great reflection on, you know, my cricket more broadly was the joy of the friendships that it created. And those friendships are enduring and everlasting, whether you play with someone or against them. I mean, they're usually always a little closer when you get to share a change room. So it's a good example of, you know, over 10 years ago, I played with these guys and here we are.
It's awesome.
You know, reminiscing 10 years later.
We talk about that a bit in the footy world too, where at the end of the game you see guys go and shake hands and you think sort of, how do they know each other? How do they know each other? And it's amazing. The cricket world's the same. You guys are all interconnected, played with and against each other for many years and the sort of strange bedfellows and the different friendships that develop over that period of time. So hit them straight. Enjoy today, Teddy, out on the links.
Thanks.
All right, let's the serious stuff. Usman Khawaja has announced his retirement at the completion of the Sydney Test. He's doing a press conference as we speak. Just listen to the first bit before I ducked in here and a few of the cliff notes. He wrote a prepared statement at the start, as you'd expect, thanking everybody that has been integral to his journey up until this point. So 88 Test matches he's going to bow out at the completion of the Sydney Test. He spoke about obviously being an example and a role model for so many people and being able to give them a chance to see themselves in the Australian team as someone who is an immigrant to Australia, obviously at a young age, born in Pakistan, goes on as a person of colour to represent Australia over a long period of time, obviously with success. He gave a bit of detail around his relationship with Andrew McDonald and the fact that he felt like he'd been attacked by the media and former players about the fact that he continued to play, you know, well into his 30s and obviously now past his 39th birthday. And the fact that McDonald had insisted that he played, particularly for the last 2 years when he said he was prepared to retire at any time. And even as recently as discussing retirement with him, McDonald raised the possibility of what it would look like if he got through to India, which is in the early months of 2027. Obviously, we sit here now some 12, you know, 14, 13 months away from that tour taking place. But he, you know, particularly spoke about, you know, he used attacked a number of times when he was talking about the way that he feels like he's been treated from past players and from media personnel. He also made a comment about golf. Essentially, you know, we know how much he loves his golf. Essentially, he said, it, you know, it's going to be a bad year in 2026 to be a titleist Pro V1, and that essentially there's nothing that any of you can say about it, as he looked out and pointed towards the media. I must admit, my first reaction at that point, I thought, well, good luck to you, Aussie. I don't have an issue with you going down there and playing golf in your free time as a retired man, as long as it doesn't conflict with his cricketing responsibilities. But there's a lot in there, Teddy. I guess what's your initial reaction to all of that?
Well, there's a bit to unpack here. I guess off the top, this is a guy who's had a phenomenal career. So, you know, my overriding emotion is one of congratulations. I think he's, I don't know, 15th or 16th probably on the all-time test run scoring list for Australia. Has played in all parts of the world, has seen test victories, has scored amazing test hundreds. And he's right, he has been an inspiration for, you know, many, many young cricketers. Not just those that came to this country, but many who were born here as well. You can't be what you can't see. And there's no doubt, particularly for South Asian immigrants, he has been a shining light. But I actually think he's a bigger figure than that. But the fact that that gives him inspiration is awesome. So a hearty congratulations. This is someone I had the joy of playing with, someone who I saw develop into the cricketer that he is, and he deserves the send-off that he'll get at the SCG. He'll get a standing ovation on the way onto the ground and off the ground, irrespective of how many runs he scores. So that's where I start. I guess where, you know, the conversation naturally leads here is the comments that you just provided around, you know, him feeling under attack at certain stages. Oh, I think that's part and parcel of being a professional cricketer, and people are allowed to voice their opinions. I feel sorry that he feels like that in many respects, but also, you know, you can't control how you do feel in these types of situations. My ears prick up a little bit, you know, hearing about effectively Andrew McDonald trying to convince him to play on. That kind of, I need to digest that a little bit more. I find that hard to believe given the nature of his cricket in the last couple of years, but he is a respected member of the team, you know, and a glue within it in many respects. And we know that McDonald's really values experience over one thing that he optimizes for in his coaching. It's people who have been there and done that. And we've seen that through the lack of young players that have kind of been initiated into the team. So I might pause there. I've kind of given you my off the cuff thoughts and feelings. How about you?
First of all, on Uzi, so incredibly debuted 2011, right? So that was the same test Michael Beer made his debut in. It was also the same test Michael Clarke led the country for the first time. So when you hear of a couple of those names, you think, man, this guy's played for a long time. There's been a whole lot of iterations, obviously, of Australian cricket since then. And when you it feels like his last chapter, which is often the case. Yeah, his last chapter, I think, is the one that we're going to remember him by the most. And I don't mean obviously the last couple of years, but I think, you know, the return to the test team obviously in the previous Ashes, the twin hundreds at the SCG, and really the fact that he beat the door down to get in. So he went from this really stylish player to a guy that had to go back, do it the hard way, led Queensland to the Shield title, and then basically by force got his way back into the team. And even from that point, he went from twin hundreds on return, leading run scorer tour of Pakistan, where Australia made its return to play there for the first time in decades. And then obviously what a moment that was for him too, as a guy that was born there, that's obviously moved to the other part of the world, you know, has represented Australia for many years and then goes back to Pakistan, has huge success. 2023, he's the Test Cricketer of the Year. same year in which he's part of a World Test Championship winning team and leading run scorer for Australia at the Ashes. So it felt like that was as high as it ever got. That was the peak of the mountain for me for Usman Khawaja and what he was able to do. And then there'd been sort of other little chapters in between. Remember that BBL run that he had with the Sydney Thunder where I think he hit 204 hits and ended up being man of the match in the final? And at that stage, you thought, gee, these guys are just about the best T20 batsmen that we've got in Australian cricket at the moment. So there's been many highs and a guy who's represented the country in all three formats. But I think they're probably the things that'll stick in my memory the most. I mean, yes, he was a stylish player and a beautiful cricketer, but he had to do it in a bunch of different ways, which is really what the international cricketing experience is all about, isn't it, for an elite batsman?
I love that little montage of the career, Corb. You're right. I mean, the thing that sticks out for me, this is a guy, who if you thought about the quintessential Khawaja shots, it's the cut shot and the pull shot, real, forceful back foot play. And yet this is someone that actually dominated, one of the rare Australians that dominated in the subcontinent. Big 100 in Pakistan, a great 200 in Sri Lanka. It's pretty rare to have those skills of being able to walk out at the whacker and pull them off your nose and also be subtle enough with your hands and your wrists at times when the ball isn't bouncing. So of all the modern players, it's probably Steve Smith and Usman Khawaja that have been able to transcend their skills across both formats, but more importantly, conditions. And it's a testament to him that he kept improving. This isn't a guy that grew up on the subcontinent. His cricket education was wholly Australian, and yet he still managed to bring that South Asian flair, to a game in different parts of the world.
That part of it, I mean, he's a proper trailblazer in that sense, isn't he? I mean, that the Australian cricket team had never seen someone quite like Uzi in the way that he was able to enter the locker room. And then as he played more and more, we learnt more and more about his personality. He revealed a lot more of that to us in the press as well and to the broader general public. And I spoke to Harja Singh recently, who talked about, one of his idols growing up was Usman Khawaja. And, their family origins don't hail from the same part of the world, not the same religion. There's not any obvious crossover apart from the fact that it's the same general region in the subcontinent. And that goes to speak to the fact that up until Uzi, and really even since then, there hasn't been so many opportunities provided in the Australian cricket landscape for people that hail from even that general area, let alone the specific place, to basically point to and say, hey, that can be me. There I am in the Australian cricket team. So hats off to him for that. I mean, over a long period of time, and this is the case with everyone, this is why we're all different as human beings. Like, I disagreed with him on the F1 thing. I agreed with him on the doves and the comments on the shoes. I was very supportive of him on that. I disagreed with him on the golf front. So I feel like with Uzi, that's always going to be the case, isn't it? Where, you don't generally agree with absolutely everything everyone does. And that's been, I think, my experience sort of covering his career for a long period of time. But I think one thing for sure, I think we're much better off having had Usman Khawaja in Australian cricket for the better part of two decades.
Yeah, without doubt. And let it be known, respectful disagreement always in your case. So, you have been a great supporter of his, as have I. And this is a guy who is a great person to share a change room with. He provides a calmness and a clarity of thought. He's got a great sense of humour. He's a team player. This is a guy that you want to play cricket with. And so I was lucky enough to do that, as were many. So he'll be very fondly remembered amongst the playing community, irrespective if the past players or not, or the perception have been, putting pressure on him one way or another.
Do you feel like that fades, though, or that mellows a little bit, post your career? Like, I mean, I imagine you would have felt that in the same way, Teddy, that it feels like, you're in the hot seat and everyone's gunning for you, example. Is there a little part where when you finish, you go, oh, okay, I see it a little bit different now, I'm not in the bubble?
Well, I hope he feels that way. I hope that would be a horrific way to live your post-cricket life. And you've seen this firsthand, and I'll give a little personal example. Who was the coach that dropped me?
Darren Lehman.
It was. And so for years after that, I was very disappointed with him for whatever reason. Now you've seen us interact. Life's too short to hold grudges.
Yeah.
He's a good person. So why would I ever hold that against him after I finish playing cricket. So I hope Usman ends up in that headspace. It might take a while, for sure. And I hope, even my own experience with Usman, I know he hasn't been particularly happy with me in the last couple of years, you know, calling balls and strikes around what I've seen with his batting and the output that he's specifically given at the top of the order. That doesn't mean I love him any less as a person, or I don't respect him, but without doubt, he probably feels that. Mm. I know he feels that. So I hope that fades.
Which gets us to the McDonald side of it. I wanted to pick up on that part because I felt like I want to give Uzi his flowers. I don't want to feel like I'm rushing to the bit about McDonald. But that's a fascinating insight for Usman to give. And as this is a guy who's always very transparent, feels like he calls it as he sees it. And I take him completely on face value that they're the conversations that he's had with Andrew McDonald, and McDonald trying to twist his arm to stay. I mentioned after the Adelaide test that I feel like by the time Andrew McDonald's done, he could be Australia's most decorated coach, right? Like, if looking at the tours that are coming up, India's not the force they once were. I mean, if they go to India and win, they've already won a 50-over crown. He was an integral part of the T20 crown. They've won the World Test Championship. There's some glamour tours still coming up, England away and everything else. You think, yeah, he has a real chance to be as decorated as we've ever seen in the coaching game. My question for you, Teddy, and maybe it's an open-ended question. Do you think the way that he leaves the team will be part of his legacy? And what I mean by that is sometimes in the moment we say, oh, he's, you know, they've walked away and all of a sudden, you know, the empire was built on sand and, you know, all of a sudden they disappear and there's nothing left. But I wonder in 40 years' time or, you know, 30 years' time when we look back on it, will we actually remember any of that? Or will we just go, look at all the great things they did when they were in charge of Australian cricket? And no matter how they left it, that's for someone else to fix up. And that won't be a reflection on McDonald and Cummins and Bailey and co. Do you think it actually matters what it looks like when he walks out?
100%. You've beaten me the punchline here. There's no doubt that people only remember what you did, not what you didn't do. And maybe there'll be a moment if the Australian team collapses in a heap for 10 seconds that people will say, oh, they didn't set this team up for success. They will quickly forget that. That is the next coach's problem. And the memory will long linger of World Cup wins and Ashes series wins, and their name is permanently attached to that. And in many respects, that's the problem with the incentives around coaching and selecting. There's no real incentive at all to have a long-term view of setting up a team. Particularly a team that is not privately owned, or, you know, there's no lasting franchise value to it. It's literally a public good, and people, you know, use and misuse it how they want. There's no doubt, you know, this group of players, this captain, this coach, this group of selectors will long be remembered incredibly favourably, and irrespective of where it really finishes, I think.
But it is the governing body's responsibility, isn't it? Like it's
it is.
The same way.
That's the leadership of the CEO or yeah. Head of cricket or whoever you want to draw up the accountability ladder. It is their job,
yep.
For sure. And you know, if you give people too much autonomy, they all act in the incentive that best serves them rather than anyone else. And so that's what's going to have to be required for sure.
100%. And that's where, you know, Baird and Greenberg. You look at that now and you think, well. As great as it is right now, and as much as, yeah, you sort of think, well, what's it going to look like in, you know, 2 years' time, in 18 months' time, in 5 years' time or whatever, and, yeah, whether at some point they're going to have to tip some resources into other areas to make sure that's protected. The test itself, so looking ahead to Sydney, there's so much speculation about what the wicket's going to look like, and classic sort of photo 5 days out where the, you know, before the mowing's been done and everything else.
Green wicket. It's a green wicket.
Correct.
No, the test doesn't start for another 4 days, folks. Calm down.
I don't get too carried away with any of that, as you know, Teddy, but makes for a great media storyline. Mm. The last two SCG tests have been two of the shortest three in the last 20 years. So basically this is the thing that is trending towards the short side as opposed to the long side. And when you look at, you know, spin-friendly wickets in Australia, it's certainly not, you know, the turner that it has been in the past, albeit it hasn't got a lot to beat in Australian cricket. I think it's equal with Perth as the most spin-friendly wicket, which is about one in every five poles to fall to slow bowlers, which, you know, isn't dramatic by any stretch, but is still as good as there is anywhere in the world. Last year in the test that finished before tea on day three, the Quicks took 33 of 34 wickets in the match. What does that mean?
Last year was a bit of an anomaly. That was as steamy a SCG wicket as you can possibly get. I mean, I do think it's a little bit of a miscategorization these days of thinking the SCG is a turning wicket, as you've just rightly pointed out, much like, you know, the green Gabba monster. That doesn't exist these days either. That's the best place to bat in the country, hands down. And so, you know, what they want to produce versus what they will produce, I think, are two different things. And I've said this for a while. I'm unsure the vision and the execution match each other when it comes to the SCG wicket. What do they want? They want a good cricket wicket with good pace that seams early, flattens out and turns late. The dream cricket wicket. Unfortunately, in recent years, given, you know, be it the grass or the weather or, you know, pick your reason, this SCG wicket has been substandard, and the last 2 years has tried to, you know, reinvigorate something, and they got it wrong last year, I thought. Oh, it wasn't a bad wicket. It was a good test match, I thought, and you'd rather see a lively wicket than a turgid one. I think we're probably going to get the latter. I think it will maybe have some grass and some seam movement, but I think it's going to be pretty good to bat on. I'm not expecting a heap of pace in it.
Is there anything wrong with that? I mean, surely we're due something like that.
Well, it depends. If the ball, if you remember, or 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the ball bounced twice in the first over of the day through to the keeper.
Yeah.
So that's good for no one because it's hard to score. Just because there's no, it's not bowler friendly, it doesn't make it batter friendly at all. We don't want to see, and you'll say, oh, but England will keep attacking. If you physically, it's just as hard to score runs on a wicket with no pace on it as it is, you know, seeming 5 centimetres. Because and the risks still exist the same.
So it's not just that it's flat, it's dead.
It's dead.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe England will take the game on aerial, but I think there's a huge risk in that. And you end up with a, you know, if teams can't score naturally, you end up with a short test match anyway because they're taking too much risk on the other side. So it is a balance. I don't think it's just a straight line through, you know, non-seeming wicket equals great cricket, particularly two teams that want to attack. But we'll see. I think it's all speculation at the moment. So, you know, let's see.
England haven't played in a draw away from home since March 2022. So under the Bazball era, I think they've played 46 tests. They've had two draws and they were both at Manchester and they were both weather affected. So we'll see what we get. Draws have been obviously in vogue at the SCG. A lot of those, must be said, have been weather affected. So six of the last 11. I don't think this is going to be weather affected, is it? Even though we're going to get rain on day one and some rain on day two, there's going to be plenty of time to get a result. So if we get a result, you think it's not going to be the pitch. It's going to be, it's not going to be the weather. It's going to be the wicket that's going to contribute to that. But six of the last 11 draws at the SCG. So throw all that together, Teddy. Is there room for Todd Murphy in the 11?
I think there has to be room for Todd Murphy. That is walking a crazy tightrope, not playing a spinner. Given what you've just described, that it will be a lengthier test, I think, given that we know late in the test match it will turn, you know, maybe not dramatically, but it will turn. And so, you know, that would be crazy to think that no Todd Murphy of the SCG. Mm-hmm. I've kind of lost track of picking this team, to be honest. So I feel a little out of touch. So I'm going to say that, and guess what? They're going to queue up the Quicks, but who knows?
No.
I mean, everyone, it's so easy to kind of move to, oh, but Bo Webster bowls off-spin. Not really. He bowled a little bit of off-spin back in the day. He's predominantly a seam bowler now, and he can roll them out, but that's not the same. They're probably no better or worse than Travis Head's.
Yeah. Do you think Webster plays?
I think Webster doesn't play, given that he was sent back to the Big Bash.
Yeah.
If I was picking the team, I probably would have thought long and hard about that for sure.
Mm. It's fascinating what they do there, because the next test then is until August. So you think, do they carry Cam for one more and then think, look, if we can just get him through to those games against Bangladesh, what are we...
Yeah, that's exactly what they're thinking.
What are we sitting down now and go,
They've got more to lose by not picking him, is I guess, how it feels, and that's not a great way to pick cricket teams.
No.
But long term, it could well be the right answer. I mean, every time he's gone back to Shield cricket, he's kind of proved that he's too good for that level.
Correct.
So he might as well just get another test into it.
Yep, and there's going to be a spot open up in the middle order anyway, with Khawaja obviously retiring at the completion of this, but it's a fascinating test match for a so-called dead rubber. And by the way, I know tickets sell like hotcakes anyway. I'm not sure it's a promoter's dream that the senior coach comes out and basically says, hey, the Ashes was done at 3-0. I'm thinking, well, if I'm holding a ticket on day 2 or 3 for the SCG quick, why am I going to watch this game that the coach is telling me it's just so-so as a contest? But it feels like an interesting test for, I think, 4 of the top 7 that are under pressure, and we've spoken a bit about them. Weatherald's had one score, but clearly they like him as a combination with Travis Head. Marnus Labuschagne short on runs, averaged 20 last calendar year. Then Smith comes in at 4, Khawaja obviously at 5. Well, really, it's only 3. We know the decision now with Khawaja. Then you've got Carey, who's just about the best player on the team, and Cam Green, obviously, who's been much discussed. So I agree with you. I think the top 7 will all play. But there's 3 of them in particular that should be handy to get a score here.
Oh, yeah. Yep. When without doubt. And it's not a test match that I don't think gets an asterisk. It's not a dead rubber against, some nondescript team in some part of the world. People remember what happens at the SCG. For whatever reason, be it the history, be it the of the series, everyone's on holidays, eyes are firmly on the test match. And so if you can score runs or take wickets, they get etched into the memory slightly deeper than other test matches for sure.
Nisa at the halfway mark was the man of the match in Melbourne. He had 4 for 45 and also 35, which was the top score in the test. And then in the second innings, he got a duck and went wicketless. So that's a mixed test match for him. He'll be, you think, at a shootout with Jai Richardson for the last spot in that Aussie team. Jai was probably trending the other way, went wicketless from only bowling 4 overs in the first innings and then got 2 for 22 in the second. Picked up Joe Root.
I'm a flat line on his last test match. There was no trending at all. I can only hope that we see more. I'd like to see more of Jai Richardson to understand exactly what he can give to the team, but low 130s, he doesn't have the height to trouble people if he's not bowling at high speeds. So we talked about bounce and movement, either sideways or up and down, and speed. So they're your three prongs to the fork if you're a fast bowler. We didn't see speed, we didn't see movement up and down, we didn't see movement sideways, and so kind of calls into question, how does he then get people out? If you're not moving the ball at 135 k's an hour, you're not getting many high-quality test players out.
He thinks he'll get quicker, and so does Stuart Clarke. I know he was big on that in our coverage, that, once he gets back in the rhythm and gets into it, feels like he can... He himself, Jai Richardson, said to me that it feels like he didn't have a great test and feels like he can get quicker the more he does it, so...
Great.
Hopefully that's the case, because fingers you're right. He needs to sort of get back into the 140s. What about Lawrence Booth's story, by the way? So this was in, I think, the Daily Mail, talking about McCullum's job appears safe in the short term, given the fact there's a T20 World Cup, which is just weeks away. Chief executive of the ECB, Richard Gould, is flying to Sydney. He's going to join the chairman, Richard Thompson, there. But with McCullum contracted until 2027, it looks as if he is going to stay on at least in the short term. Obviously, there's a home summer coming up against Pakistan and New Zealand. They play 3 each in the middle of 2026. Do you think that win alone in Melbourne, even though it was a bit of a crapshoot and they're on the right side of it, does that just help a little bit rather than, say, if they'd lost 4-0, 5-0 or whatever when it comes to making a decision around Brendan McCullum?
No, I think it's a very short-term pressure release on the valve is my read on it. I think, with the World T20 literally on our doorstep, you'd be crazy to sack him before that. That's, a banner ICC tournament that, while their T20 cricket's been pretty poor, we also know in the format that can change pretty quickly, and they've got a decent team on paper. So they're, in all likelihood going to feature in some capacity. So I think after that, they'll sit down and say, okay, where are we at? The problem being is, who is the next coach? And you start looking around, and think it's a little bit of a poison chalice in many respects, trying to coach this team after McCullum. You know, do you follow on the legacy of Bazball? Do you, you know, is it Bazball Plus? You'd have to obviously rename it something else. And so what style of play would you actually try and bring to the table? And how can you enforce that upon a team that has been so deeply ingrained with, you know, the mantra that has gone before you? So it'd be really tricky, and it would take a incredibly large personality to try and break that down.
What about Dazball? Darren Lehman out of North Ants, he can come back and coach the England national team.
Did that just come to you, or is that in your notes? Because that's good.
Might have come up over a few beers in Adelaide.
I don't. I mean, have you asked him? I don't think he would. I don't think he'd do it.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it'd be.
Not to speak for him, but not to speak for someone after a few beers. But it's a big call being an ex-Australian player coaching England.
Yeah, he always laughs it off and says Andrea wouldn't let him do it, his wife. But I don't know. Maybe it feels like he's certainly rejuvenated in his North Ants gig and sort of he's been so well received in what he's been able to do over there. So he's connected with England cricket, and I don't know. It'd be fascinating to see what happens next there.
I think Flintoff. The only thing that stopped Flintoff is he's got a good young son. Yeah.
Okay. What about Root and Stokes? So I asked Joe Root this at the end of the MCG test. Is this the last time we'll see him tour down here for the Ashes? He was pretty quick to say, oh, there's a game next year, isn't there? Obviously knowing the 150th anniversary game. So let's set that aside and say Stokes and Root come back for that. But will we see him again for another Ashes series down here? Is this it?
Oh, man, you'd be hard-pressed to say it, isn't it? But yeah, part of me thinks he'll be back in 4 years.
Ooh.
Stokes probably not. I think his body will let him down.
Yeah,
I think Root will prioritise Test cricket, I think.
Yep. Matthew Potts expected to get the call up here. He's a Durham seamer, so along with Carson Stokes, they play their cricket together there. He's the only unused fast bowler from the original squad. Hasn't played a Test match since December 2024. People will be thinking, oh, that's not that long ago. No, folks, it's now 2026, so that means that's like 13 months ago since he last played Test cricket. How hard is that to get your head around, by the way? December 2024, 36 wickets at 29 from his 10 Tests so far.
Yeah, he's not a bad bowler at all. I mean, where's your temperature on the series in terms of delivering against expectation? Obviously one Test to play, so maybe this is best saved till after the Test match, but would you say unders or overs?
Unders. We had high hopes, but 13 days of cricket's not enough. So you think about this same stage of the 2023 Ashes, so the Northern Ashes, we'd had 18 days of cricket. We would have to go 5 days here just to get to what we got to at the end of the fourth test in 2023. So, I mean, it's completely unprecedented, two-day tests. And I felt like, you know, the one in Perth was almost a bit of a novelty and it was out of the box and I really enjoyed it. There was enough in Brisbane. It was, yeah, even though England fell 2-0 behind and you thought, oh, here we go. Mitchell Starc's just unleashed hell on them and all of a sudden, you know, they're behind the eight ball already. I felt really buoyed coming out of Adelaide that was a tremendous Test match, even though the Ashes had already been decided. And then I felt like, yeah, all the air came out of the balloon in Melbourne. That just, you know, took the wind out of the series. So it feels like we need a good finish to save it from here.
But, I agree with that.
Yeah, we need a good finish. All right. I mentioned the T20 World Cup, so a couple of other matters, Teddy, before we get out of here. The squad has been named for the T20 World Cup. Now, the Aussies have all of a sudden got a little crew together. I like this setup. So Marsh and Head, obviously, is the opening pair. They've got Green, Inglis, David, Stoinis, Maxwell, all in the middle order. So some bowling options there, as well as, obviously, some power hitters. And then Cummins, Hazelwood, Ellis, you would think would be the frontline quicks, and Adam Zampa as the tweaker. Now, the other squad members, if that looks like, say, your first choice 11, Cooper Connolly's part of it, Matt Short's part of it, Xavier Bartlett gets the nod as the reserve seamer, and Matt Kuhneman they've taken as well as the second frontline spinner. What do you make of the 15 players that the Aussies have put together for this 20-team World Cup starting next month?
So I like it, and we've been hot on this train for a bit. The Aussie T20 team is both well-skilled and well-drilled, and each time they get together, they formulate, you know, a higher order cohesion around their role that, you know, we've seen come out over the last couple of years. The only thing on my mind is around the omission of Mitchell Owen, who, performed pretty well, I thought, in the West Indies in a role that he wasn't that used to. You know, in that finisher role, he bowled a couple of overs. He's a good fielder. He's got a strong arm. Maybe it's the conditions and where they're going. They needed the extra spin. I just can't see a world where Kuhneman plays, I don't think. You know, Zampa, Connolly, I kind of get. In T20, to carry a specialist spinner who doesn't bat and kind of fields is an odd one. It feels a bit off because you're not playing Zampa and Kuhneman, I don't think, and I don't think you're dropping Zampa. Yeah. So there's room for one specialist spinner, not two. And I think that's the spot that squeezed out Mitch Owen. Obviously, he does the same as a Stoinis. Maybe it was Cooper Connolly, like for like, around, you know, skilled batter who can bowl a bit. I get it. You can't pick 16, and there's going to be a hard selection choice, particularly in a team that is playing well. So I like the way the squad lined up. I probably felt for Mitch.
Yeah, felt like Mitch and Matt Short was one spot, wasn't it? And they went with Matt Short. For whatever it's worth, I don't think he's going to play much. And then Maxwell's going to be your fifth bowling option, isn't he? Like, he's going to bowl his four, you think. He'll probably bowl up front. And yeah, he's going to be a handful. So you think they got on with you, Maxwell and Zampa. That's, yeah, the only way he plays is if Zampa doesn't. It feels like it's unlikely they're going to play together. Got to get Hazelwood fit. And I think that's part of the thinking, isn't it? The way they sort of put him on ice for the remainder of the Ashes to basically say, hey, he's their best T20 bowler. Let's let him go. Ellis has got to play. And then even Xavier Bartlett, you think that's, you know, it's either him or Cummins. And if Cummins is fit, we know what's going to happen there. The guys that missed out, so no Spencer Johnson. He's barely played. Hard to pick. Ben Dorsch is overlooked, who's played a lot of cricket recently for Australia in the format. And then, you know, further down the depth chart, Sean Abbott, Aaron Hardy, who got some runs last night but hasn't had a heap of them recently. No Carey, no Phillippe. Yeah, and the other thing is a lot of people are like, oh, I'm surprised there's no reserve keeper. You can always travel an emergency or reserve, for example. And then, so I imagine, wouldn't be surprised if, say, Alex Carey does that. And then if there's an injury, for example, they can just sub him into the squad.
Yeah, no doubt. I think just the only other thing worth thinking about is, you know, they've tried to find a replacement for Mitch Stark because, you know, a variety of angles of attack are super important in the shorter formats. Just, you know, a batter doesn't get the look at the same type of bowler too often and can line them up. And having a left armer can change that a little bit. They've tried with Dorsch recently, knowing that Mitch Stark was retiring from T20 cricket. He just hasn't taken his opportunity. And this Big Bash, I think he's been pretty average, to be honest. He's a good cricketer, has shown glimpses. And Spencer Johnson, you know, his back is fragile. So, you know, that if there's one little chink in this team, I think it's probably not having that variation, both with the new and old ball. But maybe in these conditions, you don't need it.
It's a 20-team tournament, which means there's a bunch of teams that you have never heard of that are playing in this tournament. So we're grouped with Sri Lanka.
I reckon we've heard of them. You reckon we've heard of the teams?
Have you heard of Oman? Have you? Who's
yeah,
playing
I've heard
for
of Oman?
You heard of the country? Who's
I don't
playing?
Know who's playing for Oman. I've heard of them.
Sri Lanka, Zimbabwe, Ireland, Oman is Australia's group. And then the way that they do these silly tournaments. So basically, you have the pre-seedings, which goes into the next stage. So basically, they're like pre-seeded groups for the Super Eights. So basically, they're just assuming that the top eight seeds are going to win, and then they've already sort of grouped them in one side of the draw, which would mean, if we forecast that out, Australia are in the same side as India, South Africa, and the West Indies. So that's in the Super Eights format, which means only two of those four teams will make it through. It's actually not the worst place to be, because it means that you say India is the best team, which we all think that is the case. You would then have the chance to play India for all the marbles in the final, as opposed to the fact if, you know, you might cop them in a crossover in a semi-final. And I feel almost dirty for saying this, and I shouldn't, because we're going to mark this down and it's going to make me look like a fool in weeks to come. I actually like England's team. I like what England have got together, so whatever it's
okay,
worth.
Okay, okay. I mean, we'll do a full deep dive a bit close to the tournament, but I'm glad that you got that out there early. Real contrarian bet here. I think India are the team to beat.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's no doubt. I mean, India or Australia, and then I think if there's any other team other than those two, it's going to be England. All right, the BBL, Teddy. I've been watching a lot of BBL, so I've been locked in after my admission last week that I haven't seen as much as what I would have hoped. News Day delivered. We had back-to-back games. Sixers up against the Renegades. Sixers score a win with the roof open at Docklands, and Bubba Azam gets a calm half century with four boundaries and a six.
Did you enjoy that game?
No. I thought it was a little mundane. But then the Bison came out and absolutely blazed them into just about every single corner of Bellrave Oval. 164 runs stand with Aaron Hardy. Nice to see him back amongst the runs. Scorchers ended up winning that easily enough. There was enough going on in the run chase and Ashton Agar with a few wickets, but it ends the Hurricanes' dominant run of 9 in a row in their home patch, which was an equal tournament record. Both the Sixers and the Scorchers had done that previously at their home venues, but there was enough in it for your action-packed day, even though the first game was a little slow going.
Yeah, and I felt for the players in that first game, because the more you see it, Docklands, the more you realise it just ain't a great place to play cricket. When the outfield, you couldn't hit the ball along the ground, you know, no value square of the wicket. It's just a different style of cricket, totally. So let's park that. I don't think we need to dwell on that. I thought the second game was a cracker.
Yeah.
That's the reason why we love the Big Bash. A big name getting big runs. A superstar, Mitchell Marsh, going absolutely berserk. A beautiful day down in Hobart. Looked wonderful. So I think I've misread the Scorchers a little bit. At the start of the season, I saw they were missing some of their kind of older statesmen, you know, the Tyres, the Berendorfs, people that had really carried the franchise for a long period of time. Well, guess what? I think they saw the writing on the wall that they were on the way out, because they haven't given the Renegades anything. The Scorchers team probably looks energised without them. And then we've had this, you know, Ashton Turner's a great T20 player, but he's been a bit under the radar lately. He's had a great little comeback. You get Mitch Marsh powering the ball around the place. You get Cooper Connolly smacking it to all parts, and all of a sudden you think, oh God, this is going to be a really hard team to beat. And to beat the Hurricanes, as you pointed out, at Bellrive is no mean feat these days. So between the Hurricanes, the Scorchers and the Stars, you've got three teams that are playing pretty good cricket.
Just while we're on your misreads as well, I think I was looking at the table and I looked all the way down the bottom, and then I saw your grand final prediction. I thought, there's the Thunder, there's the Renegades. Last and second last on the table at the moment. By the way, Joel Davies, can you speak to someone in the Sixers? Any chance I can watch him bat a little earlier in the innings? Why am I watching Moses Enriquez and Ben Dorsch walk out, and then all of a sudden this kid comes out at like number 6 or 7 and he's hitting them into every single corner of the park?
I'll take that as a comment, not a question.
The New Year's Eve game, just three jeers go out here to the Brisbane Heat, who ruined my New Year's Eve. I went round to a mate's house. I was looking forward to watching the cricket. I walked in. I barely put the potato chips down on the counter, and they're 5 for nothing. So all of a sudden, the game felt like it was over already. And then they were dragged kicking and screaming to, you know, run a ball, got to 121, and then Chris Lynn just absolutely blazed a trail, and all of a sudden that game was over before it started. So that wasn't much of a game at all.
Didn't see a ball.
No, you were too busy having a good time. You were on the only ball you saw was the disco ball. That's what you were doing.
That's right. Honestly, it was probably 2:30 yesterday. I was like, oh, there was a game of cricket last night. I better check the score. Saw the scorecard, didn't watch the highlights. So I'm going to rely on you for that one.
Yeah, no, but what under the Strikers? They hadn't won that game for 7 years. It just surprised me a little bit how long that's... That's probably the... it's a great night. Like, people that go every single year and they put the fireworks and everything on afterwards and...
Probably the most fun I've ever had on a cricket field was playing New Year's Eve game in Adelaide. And it was that infamous / famous game when Travis Head went absolutely berserker and got a head. hit the ball. Oh, I was the guy at square leg. You'll see in the highlights that's just ripping his neck back trying to get the ball from the crowd every second shot. But it is a great game. Maybe they should just put a replay of that on every New Year's and just say, hey, indulge in this.
60,000 plus expected at the Melbourne Derby on Sunday. So the undefeated Stars up against the Melbourne Renegades. That's the day one of the test. There's actually a doubleheader, and then the Scorchers play the nightcap up against the Strikers. There's a game in Coffs Harbour this week. So bit to look out for on the BBL schedule. Have I noticed a little bit of a campaign that's been started, Teddy, to swing back the other way on privatisation? I saw Mike Atherton's comment in the Times talking about that Cricket Australia should resist the urge to privatise the BBL. Talks about the fact that Cricket Australia's current domestic structure is highly successful at developing talent and supporting the sports ecosystem, and that privatisation could skew priorities towards short-term profits and T20 formats at the expense of first-class cricket and Test cricket in Australia. And then I pick up the News Corp papers today, and all of a sudden Earl Eddings, the former chair at Cricket Australia, is also commenting and basically trying to urge Cricket Australia to stay away from the potential slush fund that is to come with the sale of the BBL teams. Have we just seen a little bit of change in sentiment, do you think, from some stakeholders at this critical juncture as we wait for further info from the governing body?
Look, I think an issue like this that is probably going to be highly contentious is going to have legitimate voices on either side of the aisle, and so they're worth listening to. And Atherton is as thoughtful as they come when it comes to cricket globally, and so I'd be weighing his views probably slightly more heavily than Earl Eddings. I mean, it's a very valid point that he raises, and where does the incentive lie for states and clubs to produce cricketers, and why are they doing that? And there are some higher order questions that definitely need to be worked through. But I mean, as we've discussed in the last couple of episodes, the train is moving, and we'll find out pretty quickly in which direction.
All right, before we get out of here, Teddy, one last thing. Josh Schoenfinger, who's a tremendous journo, works for cricket.com.au. You would have seen plenty of his work. He's been hard into the numbers, so we don't have to, and we can just read them out here. But there are a couple of fascinating numbers as we point towards the Sydney Test in terms of all-time Ashes. I was about to say highs, maybe lows, in terms of what's been is going to unfold in this series. A wicket has been lost every 40.3 deliveries, which is the lowest in Ashes history for a series of four or more matches. The previous low was back in 1902. So we haven't seen something quite like this since 1902 in terms of how quickly a wicket has fallen. With no spin bowled in Melbourne, the last Ashes test that happened was 1981 in the first test of the series. It will be the most spin-deprived Ashes series in history unless we get more than 70 overs of spin in Sydney, which is hard to think that that's not happening, is it?
Wow.
Record 1905, highest strike rate on record of 63 at the moment. The next most was the previous Ashes series of 60, probably again shows where the game is headed. And the number of two-day tests, so before 1900 we had nine. From 1901 to 1950, so the next 50 years we had six. From 1951 to 2000 we had one test that only went 2 days. And then from 2001 to 2020, we had five. And now in a five-year period, 2021 to now, we've had six already. So all of a sudden, it's like a little, what do we call the inverted bell curve? Or is that...
It's a U.
It's a, whatever. We'll just roll with the U. The U's front of mind for college football fans at the moment. So that doesn't bode well.
But it's fascinating stats. I can't believe it's taking you 50 minutes to bring that up. That is good stuff. Maybe we can, at the end of the series, let's unpick that a little bit, because it kind of signals exactly where we are in Test cricket more broadly. So, fascinating. Thanks for digging that up.
You got a tea time with Brody, so enjoy that. And your Knotts, former Knotts teammates, and I'll leave you to it. I will see you in person at Stumps on day one right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast.
Can't wait, Cole.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.